is A23-1672, in the matter of the application by Northern States Power Company, DBA Xcel Energy, for authority to increase rates for electric service in the state of Minnesota. We only have, we have two parties arguing, correct? So each of you has 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. This case is being live streamed. We'll keep an audio recording only on our later public website. When you begin your arguments, please state your name, party represent for the record. And the podium toggles up and down as you want. And with that, I believe we are ready for you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Matthew Price on behalf of Northern States Power, doing business as Xcel Energy. This appeal arises from Xcel Energy's rate application for 2022 through 2024. And the common thread running through each of the three issues that we've presented to the court is that the commission has exercised its will, not judgment, in making a decision that's unsupported by the record evidence and contrary to law. First, the commission excluded the prepaid pension asset from rate base based on the same rationales that this court rejected in Minnesota Power, decided just a few weeks ago. Second, the commission disallowed insurance premium expense for reasons that were unsupported by the record. It assumed that the insurance premium expense for 2022 would be the same as 2021, which was counter to undisputed evidence in the record. And the third, the commission limited recovery of base salaries and annual incentive compensation for the top 10 executives to $150,000 each, based solely on an arbitrary comparison to the governor's salary. I want to discuss each of those in turn, but begin with the prepaid pension asset issue because of the Minnesota Power case, which was decided after a briefing was complete in this case, and we think disposes of that issue. So Minnesota Power decided the very same issue. It rejected the exact same rationales the commission advanced in this case, that the prepaid pension asset is not an expensive capital nature, rejected that argument. It rejected as arbitrary and capricious the rationales the commission gave about the prepaid pension asset being different because it's temporary and fluctuates. So we think the only question that's really left after Minnesota Power is whether to reverse or remand this case for further proceedings before the commission on that issue.
But Minnesota Power doesn't seem to be a one-size-fits-all case. I mean, my reading of that case, our court said our review was frustrated by a lack of specificity. And we have a different level of specificity in this record where the commission agreed with the ALJ and the ALJ's decision here and credited experts' testimony. So why isn't that sufficient to distinguish Minnesota Power?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, I'd note that the ALJ decision in this case was made after the commission decision in Minnesota Power, so I think the ALJ was kind of reading the room and understanding where the commission was heading. But the reason why it's the same case is because the fundamental record on the issues of, you know, temporary and fluctuating asset is very, very similar to Minnesota Power. I mean, if you look at addendum 233 and 34 of our addendum, you'll see that there's expert testimony explaining, no, this asset is just like many other assets that also are temporary and fluctuate in value based on changes over time, and there's nothing that distinguishes this asset from other assets that are included in rate base. So it would just be very odd for the commission to be able to permissibly reach diametrically opposite conclusions based on basically the same kinds of considerations in the record in two different cases.
Counsel, I mean, the salient distinction for me on the Minnesota Power case is that here the commission rejected the prepaid pension asset benefit for two reasons. One was the categorical exclusion, which you've addressed, but the other is the finding that your client did not meet its burden of proof before the ALJ to establish that that asset should be included. So what do we do with that finding, which was not part of the issue on appeal in Minnesota Power?
Well, I think that finding, again, rests on really two rationales. The first rationale was this temporary fluctuating asset notion, which, again, is just, that's That is an unreasoned distinction from other assets for the same reasons this court held in Minnesota Power, and the decision below can't be affirmed on that basis. And the other had to do with the extent to which the prepaid pension asset was attributable to something other than shareholder contributions. That was the second rationale. So I want to talk about that, if I may, for a moment.
And you'd agree that's a fact-intensive inquiry, or at least a battle of the experts.
Well, I think in theory it's a battle of the experts, but I think if you look carefully at the decision and at the testimony in this case, there actually is no battle, because our evidence on this issue is not in dispute, and I'd like to try to explain why that is.
This is exactly where I want to head. So what we're getting to is, I think, the effect of market returns, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
And Minnesota Power, of course, we said that we remanded because we said the parties disputed the extent to which the prepaid pension asset is attributable to shareholder contributions as opposed to market returns. The commission is charged with resolving it. We sent it back. I don't know if there's a different evidentiary basis there that would, or if you just think that was wrong there, or if this case is different such that it's ascertainable here versus there.
This case is different, and so let me explain why. So the first is that if you read the order very carefully, in Order 2627, the order never states that Xcel's prepaid pension asset is funded by anything other than shareholder contributions. Never states that, never makes that finding in the order. So that's number one. Number two is, in Minnesota Power, the issue of market returns was a concern because of the possibility of what was called negative pension expense. The idea that theoretically market returns could be higher than pension expense in a given year, and that excess would flow through into the prepaid pension asset and increase the prepaid pension asset so that it would be funded by something in addition to simply shareholder contributions. And the evidence in this record, which is undisputed, is that Xcel Energy, unlike most utilities, uses what's called the aggregate cost method for determining pension expense. And this is on addendum page 252. It explains that the aggregate cost method has a minimum expense provision of zero. So unlike other methods which can have negative pension expense, the aggregate cost method has a minimum expense provision of zero, so you can never have negative pension expense in the Xcel's pension fund.
So when we look at, and I know that the PUC said, oh, it's perplexing, because when you say contributions less expenses, obviously if you reduce contributions because market returns exist to go toward that aspect, right? The expenses. You reduce the expenses, therefore just mathematically the prepaid pension asset is going to go up. I mean, that's not what I understand. It's like, oh, this is perplexing, because you change one part of the equation, it's going to change the other. And so is negative pension expense like a necessary, and let me just say, you can see I have some confusion about this. When you say this case is exactly like New Mexico, which I think you say in the briefing, this is just like New Mexico. When I look at the footnote in that New Mexico case, it talks about, you know, we emphasize shareholder contributions do not solely drive prepaid pension asset balances. And then it says, you know, and it talks about market returns. And then it says, in short, simply placing a prepaid pension asset in a rate base allows utilities to earn returns on amounts that are not shareholder contributions, which I think is saying is bad, would be wrong. Maybe I'm misunderstanding. So I'm having, when I look at these things, they seem to suggest that there's more work to be done.
Sure. So let me see if I can help.
Okay.
So first of all, it's not exactly like New Mexico in this one respect, which is that I don't know what method they were using in New Mexico, but I can tell you that the method for pension expense that Xcel uses, that the commission has approved, is the aggregate cost method. Everyone agrees about that. It's undisputed. And there is no possibility for negative pension expense under that method. And that's, again, addendum 252. So, but let me take a step back and just explain what the prepaid pension asset is, because that might help. So every year, Xcel has a pension expense, which is actuarially calculated, and it recovers that expense by passing it through in its rates to customers. Okay, so that's pension expense. And it also makes contributions to the pension fund, again, according to federal law, and those are the contributions that it makes. Okay, and the prepaid pension asset is the total cumulative contributions minus the total cumulative expense. It's effectively a prepayment by shareholders of pension expense that will be recovered later in time. That's what it is. So when pension expense if there are market returns on the prepaid pension asset, that does reduce pension expense. We agree with that. It affects pension expense, which is, by the way, all that the other side's expert said, is that it affects pension expense. We agree, it affects pension expense. but affecting pension expense is very different than funding the prepaid pension asset. What does it mean to affect pension expense? It means that the next year's pension expense is going to be less than it otherwise would have been, which means that the shareholders are going to recover less of their prepaid pension asset than they otherwise would have, and but the cumulative contributions are the same. Market returns can never cause the prepaid pension asset to become larger than it otherwise would have been.
So in my simple way of thinking about it, is the argument is you put in X amount, like the 100, which is what you have in your chart to explain it to us, and whether you get the recovery versus expenses or the recovery on that, that the 100 you're entitled to recovery on. So if this changes, the proportion changes due to, you know, market returns where expenses that you would recover on goes down, then this goes up.
Well, think of it like it's just an asset, right? So let's imagine it as a pole that Excel buys. Excel buys a pole for $10. It invests $10. It's going to recover that $10 over time by depreciating the pole, just like pension expense effectively depreciates the prepaid pension asset. So it's going to recover that, say, in 10 years, a dollar a year. But let's say 1 year, instead of recovering a dollar, it only recovers 50 cents. Well, it's still $10 that's been invested in the pole. And the same is true with the prepaid pension asset. So the fact that it only recovers 50 cents of pension expense in a year instead of a dollar because of market returns doesn't change the fact that investors have still put $10 into the prepaid pension asset, and they're entitled to recover the balance of what they haven't yet recovered. And that's the situation in this case.
And you would say that's what makes it different from
makes it different than Minnesota Power, because in Minnesota Power there was the possibility that there could be negative pension expense. So instead of recovering only 50 cents, there's a possibility that they could earn 50 cents. And the next year, the balance would grow by 50 cents. It would be 10.50 instead of $10. That can't happen for Xcel Energy because, again, the minimum expense is always zero. If there are excess market returns, they go into the pension trust to reduce future pension expense, but they never go into the prepaid pension asset.
I don't know if we have more questions than that. I'm very mindful of your time.
No, I appreciate it. I'm here to answer your questions.
Okay. So. Do you want to move to next things? You think?
Sure.
Okay.
Absolutely. So let me talk a little bit about insurance premium expense. So I just want to be clear about what the issue in dispute is. It's about the projected expense for 2022. That is the forecast that leads into 23 and 24. And what the commission did here was cherry pick 2021 actuals as a base, as that 2022 base, even though the undisputed evidence showed that it was an outlier and that the 2022 actuals were almost exactly as forecast. And I think here we do have ALJ findings that are very precise and in our favor. Point to the court to 609 through 612 of the ALJ's findings, talks about the accuracy and thoroughness of our forecast, and notes the 0.4% variance between the 2022 forecast and the 2022 actuals, that the department witness didn't dispute those aspects. The commission nevertheless disallowed by what it perceived was a large increase between 2021 actuals and the 2022 forecast. And I think it's very important to peel back a little bit what those numbers are to understand what was driving that increase. And I want to distinguish between two components of insurance premium expense. The first is the insurance we buy in the marketplace, and the second are surplus distributions that we receive from mutual insurers and captive insurance. With respect to the first, the evidence showed our forecast in 2022 was 8% higher than 2021 actuals, not a huge increase. There was a robust explanation of why, having to do with hardening the insurance market. And our past forecasts of that first category were extremely accurate. You can compare, in the record only contains 2 years of comparison of actuals to forecast, 2021 and 2022, and if you look at the charts, you'll have to bring out your magnifying glass, but pages 14432 and page 34432 of the record, you can see there's a 0.6% divergence for 2021 and a 0.4% divergence for 2022. So with respect to that first category, actuals and forecasts were really quite accurate. And if you look at the commission's reasoning for rejecting, it's all about that first category, that hurricanes don't happen in Minnesota, that we didn't bring in insurance brokers to talk about the market, totally disconnected from what the actual evidence showed about those those market purchases of insurance. The difference is really being driven by surplus distributions, because the 2021 surplus distribution was very large. The commission acknowledges it was unanticipated. And
don't your forecasts, aren't they net of the expected distributions? When you say actual, you just mean the bills.
Well, no, I mean the actual net insurance.
It's net, right.
It's net.
Okay.
But my point is the swing and the increase.
Right, and that one was an anomalous year is what you're saying.
Yeah, it's being driven entirely by the surplus distribution.
And then for the previous years, you say there's no way to compare the forecasted amounts in this record with the actual, well, I don't want to use the word, with the ultimate expense net of of distributions. Whereas I think that there was at least raised the idea that that was unreliable because there always was, that the forecasts were always high and they benefited the Excel. And you're saying there's not evidence for that. Is there evidence to show that they were close? That they were right? Is it just evidence that they were good or not?
That. Okay. So they rely, and I know I'm running out of time, but if I can just try to answer the question. They rely on this statement that the commission makes in its order, that the record shows that Excel's process significantly forecasted insurance insurance expenses from 2017 to 2021. That may be what you're talking about, Your Honor. It's correct. On page 68 of the order. It was based on an assertion by the department in briefing. There's no citation to the record that the commission provides. When the department describes this in its brief, there's no citation to the record, and that's not surprising because there actually is no record evidence whatsoever to support that. I've searched high and low on the record. The only 2 years where there's actual data about forecasts and actuals are 2021 and 2022. That's it. And there's a reason for this, which is that Excel's last rate case was in 2015 with a 2016 test year, and only the 2016 year had a full budget forecast detail. And that case was resolved with a black box settlement, so there was a stated rate that emerged from it, and no one broke things out by individual expense category after that.
And then one more thing, and then I would like to give some extra time for our panel to address the compensation, we're going to do that. For the 2022, where you say the actuals match the forecast, I think one of the arguments I heard is that testimony, which was very brief, didn't state whether it took into account or not distributions that were made that year.
So I think that testimony is unclear about whether it did, but there was further testimony that, or further evidence that we submitted on reconsideration when the 2022 year was complete, that indicated that actually the forecast distribution was a couple million dollars, that the forecast was a couple million dollars greater than the actuals after accounting for the surplus distribution. So in other words, we actually under-recovered relative to the forecast in 2022.
And was that the evidence that was not?
That's correct.
Permitted?
It's in the record, but it was. I mean, it's proffered, but it was it was not received. That's
all right. Let's turn to executive compensation, and I will just start with like a first thing.
Great.
Excel doesn't come in saying we want the full market rates of our total executive compensation.
We have not appealed that, Your Honor. We're talking about base.
I mean, just a base.
Base plus 15% that is ordinarily would be otherwise allowed under the commission's decision for employees, 15% annual incentive program compensation plus the base. So that's what the commission allowed.
Did the $7 million? This is my question. I'm going to call it $7 million.
Yeah.
Did that number come from base plus AIP, or was it just base?
The $7 million should be base plus 15% of AIP.
Okay, that wasn't clear to me in the briefing that it included that. I know there's an objection to excluding AIP, but it wasn't clear what the $7 million is. But I guess here's my overarching question. Excel doesn't say that didn't ask that ratepayers bear the full cost, essentially, of total comp. Apparently recognizing that market rates for total comp is not something that, you know, ratepayers should exclusively bear. So what makes Excel's decision to make part of it base comp, you know, to set base comp at wherever it sets it, why is that? What's the evidence that shows that that's the right place? And then conversely, that, you know, $150,000 per employee versus $700,000 per employee is the wrong place. Like, that's what I'm trying to figure out, because it doesn't seem like anyone is suggesting that it should be the full total comp. And the evidence went to show that total compensation is, you know, you're at the median for total comp.
And what the evidence also showed is that we're actually slightly less than the median for base. And so if you look at the Willis Towers Watson study and the Lowenthal testimony, what it explains is that we set comp based on market-based benchmarks. We compete for executives on a national basis, and the compensation is set near the median. The overall comp is set near the median what the market pays, but the base is actually slightly less than the median. So that
why does base equate to the value to, why does that equate to the interests of ratepayers versus shareholders? I mean, base seems to be an HR determination that the employer can make. We're going to do mostly base versus like some incentive. You know, I'm trying to figure out what proves that's the right number. What if you chose to make it, you know, $800,000 per employee as base?
Yeah, so I guess two answers to that, Your Honor. The first is I don't want to implicitly concede that we don't think we should be able to recover the entire comp. But we're not arguing that in this case. I just want to make that clear on the record. But with
and was not requested.
And was not requested. Yeah. With respect to your question, I mean, there are market benchmarks for how companies divide up the comp between base and other kinds of components, and the base just doesn't include stock performance related compensation. So it seems like, you know, if you're looking at what a reasonable cost is, again, taking away any kind of stock performance incentive, well, the base is a good measure for that. And again, there was no counter evidence at all that this is not a, you know, the base is too high. You know, you could attract similar candidates for less. There was no counter evidence. It was sua sponte brought up by the commission, and they picked $150,000 effectively out of a hat without any evidentiary support for showing that that is a reasonable amount to pay for executives that really are necessary to furnish service.
Can I ask a follow-up question on that, counsel? What, in your view, would the commission have needed to say in order to justify its choice of using the governor's salary as an appropriate benchmark for executive compensation?
Well, I think if there had been record evidence, for example, that you can go to the market and hire utility executives for $150,000 a year, that would be something. I mean, but without that, that would give them an evidentiary basis. But that didn't exist.
I mean, that, in an ideal world, that might be what you would have hoped for. But what I'm asking is a little bit different, and that is, what is the minimum that the commission would have had to say in order to justify its choice, in your view, under the law?
I think they needed some evidence that $150,000 is enough to furnish enough to provide a necessary recovery to furnish service, and you know there's no evidence.
Why was $700,000 per exec per year request enough if that's well below the market?
Well, it's slightly below the median. Slightly below the median
of base.
Of base.
And you say the evidence shows the base, so it should be determined based on base, and that's what the commission has to do, even though and not total comp.
I'm not here asking for total comp. I'm asking just for the base plus the AIP that was allowed generally for employees, right? And my point is just the undisputed evidence, the only evidence in the record showed that was at median for the market for that labor.
For base. Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much for the extra time.
Spending more time with us. Counsel for respondent. Of course, we did about 7 or 8 minutes extra, so.
Sorry, how much?
7 or 8 minutes, yep. We'll just add that on. Add on 8. I think it was more than 7. Thank you, Marshall.
All right. May it please the court, my name is Jeffrey Bowman, and I represent the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. Your Honors, this is a case about a utility's failure to carry its burden of proof. The utility has the burden of proof at all times to prove the reasonableness of its requested rate increase, and any doubt as to reasonableness must be resolved in favor of the ratepayers. In the Commission's final order, which spanned 166 pages and resolved over 70 disputed issues, the commission ultimately granted the company a $330 million rate increase, or approximately 14% over the course of the multi-year rate plan. Despite this large increase, the company wants more. On all three issues in this appeal, the Commission properly determined that the company failed to meet its burden of proof, and the Commission's decisions should be affirmed. I will first address prepaid pension asset, followed by insurance expense, and finally the top 10 executive compensation.
Before we get to those, do you think, or is it the PUC's position that the quasi-legislative standard of review applies to any of the three issues before us?
Your Honor, the Commission analyzed this case under the substantial evidence test, and the reason it did that is under the Northern States Power case, it acknowledged that whether a cost item is included in rates or not is both a quasi-judicial and partially legislative determination. Despite that fact, they applied the substantial evidence standard. I do want to admit, or I do want to say, that there is merit to the other sides, or not the other sides, XLIs, right, the departments, and the OAG's argument that the clear and convincing standard should apply. That's because if you look at the 1998 Interstate Power case, it's saying when you are making distinctions about whether ratepayers or shareholders should bear that cost, that is a quasi-legislative determination, and the clear and convincing standard can apply. So there's some ambiguity here, but it's not ambiguity that this court has to resolve in this case, because remember, the substantial evidence test in rate making is different. It's did you explain what you did, and is it reasonable? And under either standard of review, the Commission's decision passes muster, Your Honor.
Thank you.
All right. Turning first to the...
When you're talking about the prepaid pension asset, which I think where you're going,
absolutely,
Counsel, it would be helpful, as I understand it, the PUC did not appeal the Minnesota Power decision, did not submit a petition for further review, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And so help me understand why... The announced decision in the Commission's order in this case that prepaid pension benefit asset should be categorically excluded is not squarely within the determination that in Minnesota Power that that's a no-no.
Sure, Your Honor. As you know, in the Minnesota Power case, the court held that a utility's mandatory contributions to a pension plan are an expense of a capital nature that the Commission must give due consideration.
Right.
So I read that case to mean that we can't categorically and in its entirety exclude it to the extent it is shareholder funded. So that is the issue I want the court to focus on today. Is it shareholder funded? There's no dispute, I think, on this record or as to the law that the utility can only recover or only rate-based items that are in fact provided by investors or shareholders. That's the whole point of rate-based, to allow them to earn a return on their dollars.
Just to back up for a second, on Judge Frisch's point and the point she made earlier, too, there were two reasons the Commission denied. One was a categorical exclusion, and I think you're saying Minnesota Power says no. That's wrong.
That's correct. If we accept the holding of Minnesota Power, it doesn't mean that every prepaid pension asset is going to get into rate base. So when the Commission analyzes whether something is rate base or not, the company still has to prove that it's used and useful. They still have to prove that it's prudent. So on the Minnesota Power remand, you know, whether or not that prepaid pension asset actually ultimately gets included for rates, that's a question for the Commission to decide. So it doesn't say it automatically has to be included, and certainly you have that threshold question that only shareholder contributions or investor-funded items are going to be placed into rate base. So,
right.
Again, I'm not arguing today that with the limited time I have that this is fundamentally different.
We're in the second sort of
we're
determination
in the second portion
the Commission
of that.
Made, which is
correct.
Excel didn't meet its burden
right
here.
Okay. And opposing counsel referenced in his argument that the Commission didn't make that finding in its order. But I would direct you to the Commission order that says it accepts all findings and conclusions of the ALJ to the extent that they're consistent with the ALJ report. We specifically said that we agree with the ALJ. We adopted that ALJ finding, and that's why this case is very different than the Minnesota Power case. In the Minnesota Power case, you had an ALJ that said the company met its burden to show that it's 100% shareholder funded. This court in the Minnesota Power case was struggling with the lack of specificity of why we rejected that ALJ finding. And that's why it was remanded in that case. That's not present here. You have an ALJ report that says that the department has shown that the prepaid pension asset is affected by market returns, and so there is doubt as to the source of the funding, and therefore Xcel hasn't met its burden. And so I want to address
the structural problem that I have with the commission's decision here is that it seems as though the decision sort of leads with its chin, right? That we've excluded this before categorically, we're excluding it now categorically. And PSM, by the way, you didn't meet your burden to say that it's something other than what we have categorized as something that should be excluded from the rate base. That's how I read it. Why is my reading not?
Your Honor, I don't think your reading is wrong, but it doesn't affect what this court does as far as whether it remands or whether it affirms the commission decision. Obviously, we didn't have the benefit of the Minnesota Power decision either when the commission made its decision or when I briefed this case. But the point is there are two independent, distinct rationales for the denial of it, and Xcel has to prove both of those to include the prepaid pension asset and rate base. And I just want to
be actually my question, really. Are they independent? Because the way that I'm reading this part of the commission's order, it seems that they are interrelated, that we're excluding it, it's not part of it, you didn't meet your burden to show that it's anything other than what we've always excluded, you're out.
Your Honor, they are related, but if you look to the ALJ report specifically, which again is the distinction between this case and the Minnesota Power case, there's a separate finding, I believe it's finding 314, but it's right around there, where the ALJ specifically states that there is doubt as to the source of it because of market returns. That is an explicit finding in the ALJ report. It was adopted by this commission. And again, the problem in the Minnesota Power...
But I think Xcel would say, well, then they're both wrong. That on this record, one could only, the ALJ and the commission, that is just unsupportable based on the record that there's doubt that market returns affects the prepaid pension asset. And
Sure. Your Honor, and
the only answer is that it doesn't, based on the record that's before.
So if I'm understanding, I'll just address the arguments that this is shareholder funded, because I think that's what this court has to resolve. And just to be clear, the Minnesota Power case didn't change the burden of proof. And I think that's important, that the commission has a duty to set just and reasonable rates, but it does so based on the evidence submitted by the parties. And that's detailed in the Interstate Power case in 1993, a duty to do it based on the evidence submitted by the parties. So look to what Xcel submitted to support its finding that this is shareholder funded. We have a single schedule detailing contributions and expenses from 2015 to 2022. That's all we have. In the Minnesota...
We have testimony, though, from their expert,
right.
Mr. Grube, right?
Shruby, I believe, Your Honor.
Okay. Which, questions, how do market rates affect it? No, here's why, et cetera.
Yeah. So let me address this, because there's a lot of confusion about how market returns affect this. And this was frustrating, because at various times in the brief, Xcel indicated that this doesn't affect the prepaid pension asset. Market returns don't affect the prepaid pension asset. It only affects expense. As you pointed out, Your Honor, earlier, that if something affects pension expense and you net two numbers, then it, by definition, affects the prepaid pension asset itself. And so that's inherent in the formula, and I think it's important to understand what prepaid pension expense is and what prepaid pension expense isn't. And one of the problems we have here is Xcel keeps saying prepaid pension expense is the amount recovered from ratepayers. It's not the amount actually recovered from ratepayers.
The expense?
Correct, Your Honor. It is set on a representative test year amount. So if they have a rate case in 2020 and they set a pension expense as a representative amount, that's what they recover from ratepayers moving forward. It's completely untethered to the pension expense that record on their ledger, which is what they're actually netting out when they calculate the pension expense. So all these arguments about, well, it's cumulative and the ratepayers pay it, it's not true. It's not what they've recovered from ratepayers, and that's problematic. And because it's an
action to where that is in the record, my understanding was that their calculation and their accounting principles were different and also accepted by the commission.
So that's a basic test year concept under 216B.16.
What the test year is.
Okay, so what, I'm sorry, I'm not understanding your question.
It's all right, go ahead.
Okay, so, but to talk about the shareholder funding, I think it's important because imagine you have $100 in contributions and $50 of expense. Pension expense takes into account market returns, and it works to reduce the pension expense. 100 minus 50, you would have $50 in prepaid pension asset. If market returns decrease that to 40, now you have $60. It has nothing to do with additional contributions. And this idea that it doesn't go negative, so it doesn't affect prepaid pension asset, it's a red herring. Obviously, it's more pronounced when pension expense goes negative, but it still affects the prepaid pension asset. It's recognized by the New Mexico case, relied on by Excel in the brief. It's recognized by the court in the Minnesota Power case. But again, it's a complicated calculation, and you don't have to resolve it in this case. You don't have to be the judges that figure out how negative pension expense and market returns affect the prepaid pension asset. All you have to find is that the commission properly determined there was doubt as to the source of the funding, and that is enough to affirm the commission's decision.
Even if that expression of doubt as to source might have been influenced by other factors that seem to be rejected by Minnesota Power. I think that's part of it's so brief, you know, the analysis. My question.
Your Honor,
is this a remand situation to help for the PUC to address more fully?
I think worst case scenario, it's a remand situation. This court doesn't have to do that because Excel shouldn't get a second bite at the apple to prove this is shareholder funded when they haven't done it. And you can look to their own testimony. So looking to their own testimony, Shruby direct testimony, I believe it's page 83, he talks about how pension expense, it affects market returns, but you could also simply add it to the side of the equation as contributions, and it would have the same effect. So whether it decreases pension expense or whether you count it as a contribution, it has the same net effect on the prepaid pension asset. And that is the key here. And I think Excel and the other parties maybe are talking past each other a little bit here, because I'm claiming that the fact that market returns drive the prepaid pension asset is undisputed. It can't be disputed based on the expert testimony and on the inherent formula. And they're saying, of course, market returns actually play no part in the prepaid pension asset. But if you look to Shruby's testimony, that's not really the testimony they provided in front of the commission. What they said is that the market returns are in effect involuntary contributions of the company. So what Excel, I think, is really arguing here is that not that market returns don't affect the prepaid pension asset, not that a decrease in pension expense doesn't increase the prepaid pension asset, but that in reality, we should be entitled to return on the market returns. There are market
because
returns.
Because of the way this all operates.
Right. Yeah, right. So, but that wasn't really briefed in front of the parties. That wasn't the position they took in their brief. And you can have that discussion. It hasn't occurred yet, but you don't need to have it because Excel hasn't put forth the evidence in the record to even have that conversation. They asked for a return on this prepaid pension asset going back to the plan's inception. Again, I have one schedule going back to 2015. I have nothing in the record actually detailing over the life of the asset how the different contributions and negative pension expense affect the asset. Simply not in the record. In Minnesota Power, to their credit, that was actually in the record.
And maybe I'm completely off base here, but what I was hearing is that all of these market returns are placed into the trust, which is separate than placing it into the asset.
So, Your Honor, the asset...
How do you address that accounting principle?
The fact that the asset itself doesn't exist. It simply doesn't exist. It's an accounting entry. So the fund is the actual contributions and the fair market value of the asset or of the plan. That is the pension plan. The asset itself is just contributions netted against what we've recorded in our books. It doesn't reflect an actual amount of money sitting in any account anywhere.
So I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked when I was hearing the Minnesota Power case, and that is, it's a very, I appreciate all of these arguments. I'm not seeing any of this in the commission's order. So what do we do with that? Because we're not reviewing your argument, we're reviewing the order to determine whether it's supported by substantial evidence.
Your Honor, I have two responses to that. One I've already said, which is that we adopted the ALJ report. It does reference the specific department testimony that the ALJ relied on in finding that the source of the funds was in doubt. I'd also direct you to the Space Center Transport case that I cite in my brief, which essentially says the court can't provide a basis that's not provided by the administrative agency. I'm not asking this court to find an additional basis. That court says if the agency's path is reasonably discernible, then you must uphold. And in fact, that language comes from a 1942.
Let me push back on you a little bit, because you adopted the ALJ's report to an extent. The ALJ said this needs to be recalculated and said we're going to have you go recalculate it. And the commission said zero. So why not, if there is doubt, why not have it recalculated?
So Your Honor, my first answer to that is Excel hasn't appealed that decision. The second point of that, I think the calculation that Excel is asking us to do, where you basically, in the calculation of the pension expense, you take out the market returns, seems to be an admission that market returns actually do play a role in the prepaid pension asset. If the alternative that they indicated that the commission should do involved bifurcating or partitioning out those assets. But I think the third point is it might be an appropriate adjustment based on a different record. That's the problem, is that the commission rejected that because it wasn't substantiated. The department reviewed those calculations and could not figure out whether those were the appropriate calculations or not. So in a future rate case, and Excel is represented to the commission that they'll be filing a rate case I believe this week, Excel will have every opportunity to prove that this is shareholder funded, that it was prudent investments, that it's used and useful, and that some additional adjustment isn't necessary to that asset. But based on this particular record, there's simply, again, it's complex, and there wasn't enough in the record for the commission to undertake that math, to do that adjustment, especially in a world where Excel is on one hand arguing that market returns don't drive the asset, don't affect the prepaid pension asset, but also if you disagree, you should take out the market returns. It simply doesn't make sense. There was no trust in the commission's or the company's math, Your Honor.
Is there some evidence in this record that a portion of this is shareholder funded?
No, Your Honor. The initial contributions, I don't think anyone is necessarily disputing the company wrote the initial check. But if you look at the rate-based statute, you look at the cost of property when it's first devoted to public use, right? And you don't look at replacement value. So what that means is that at most, Excel can recover their initial outlay of capital, not market returns on top of that initial outlay. And so like when we have a power plant that's placed into rate base, if investors place $100 million, invest into that plant, that's what goes into rate base. That's what they earn a rate of return on. We don't come back the next year and say, well, that power plant appreciated in value. We're going to update that, and they get a return on the new appreciated value. So, you know, I think that's a key distinction.
But is it, I guess my question is there some evidence in this record that there is the utility paid the mandatory contribution that is separate from what the market rates dictate?
Yes, Your Honor. So if you look at...
If there is that evidence that exists, why isn't that then a categorical denial per Minnesota Power versus what the ALJ said should happen here is to go recalculate?
So the problem is there is evidence of the contributions to the plan. There isn't a schedule detailing the actual prepaid pension asset and how the actual expense recorded on the ledger going back to the plan's inception. And the reason that's important is look at what Excel did give us. And I believe it's Schedule 6 of Shruby's testimony. And it shows, and he details this in his testimony, that Excel Energy, the parent company, has put in the plan $1.4 billion or so and received $4.7 billion in market returns. So Excel hasn't done the math. I'm not attempting to do the math for you today, but when I see $1.5 billion in contributions and $4.6 billion in market returns, I have a hunch that when you actually do the math, that there isn't going to be a prepaid pension asset that's shareholder funded. I don't know if that's true or not. That's a discussion for the next rate case, but there certainly isn't evidence in this record that that it's shareholder funded, or what portion of it is shareholder funded that would allow the company to put it into rate base. And so I understand the inclination to, well, why don't we remand it to the commission and do the same thing in Minnesota Power? But again, I think that would be a misapplication of the burden of proof in this case, because what that does is say is the commission, you have an independent duty to set just and reasonable rates. But under the Interstate Power case, we have a duty to set just and reasonable rates based on the information supplied by Xcel. And there's absolutely no way on this record to partition out, going back to the plan's inception, what is shareholder funded and what is not shareholder funded. And Your Honors, I have 2 minutes to address the next two things.
Go ahead.
And so I would just...
Council, can I just ask you directly about executive compensation?
Yes.
Since we're moving on. I am concerned about the assignment of the governor's salary. When I look at MMB's website of the top public official salary in the state of Minnesota, the governor falls at number 122 on the salary list. And for example, the executive director of the state's investment board is in the top 10. He makes $450,000 a year, for example. I don't see a justification in the commission's order for choosing an executive at the state level who falls out of the top 100 as opposed to in the top 10. So can you provide me with some rationale as to why what the commission did here is not an exercise of anything other than its will?
Yes, Your Honor. So I think one, I don't think the commission is asserting this is the only proxy, or that it doesn't even necessarily have to be the best proxy to be upheld by this court. It has to be reasonable. And so when you look at what the commission did, it said, why are we concerned with limiting executive comp? Because it's too closely tied to shareholder interests. So the commission looked to the top executive as far as decision-making authority that doesn't have that sort of fiduciary duty or pressure to maximize profit for shareholders, and it set it at that rate. But I want to be clear that under the Interstate Power case, if the commission finds that the company doesn't meet its burden of proof, it can either deny it outright or set a reasonable amount.
I completely agree that the commission has the authority to set a reasonable amount. My question is more precise, and that is, what is the basis for determining that that salary is a reasonable amount as opposed to a different public official salary with more specialized knowledge as compared to the top 10 executives, the CFO, the general counsel? I mean, those are all very specialized positions within an electric utility.
Your Honor, I think there are other proxies the commission could have used. I don't think it renders this unreasonable. Again, to not be arbitrary and capricious, there has to be a relation between the facts found and the choices made. That's there here. I understand
and
that
where
it might
is that? Here. I'm just looking at the order.
You have to, Your Honor, you have to read both paragraphs in conjunction. Why did we deny it? Well, because of shareholder interests being too closely tied. So then what are we going to do? We're going to point to the state executive that doesn't have those interests. So could the commission have said more? Absolutely. But there's sufficient direction to discern what the commission could do. And, Your Honor, I see I'm out of time. I don't know if I could have 1 minute to address insurance expense or not.
I still have some questions about the salary, because I'm struggling with the same thing Judge Frisch is, of why was this a reasonable choice? I mean, the president of the University of Minnesota makes $1 million a year. PJ Flex makes $6 million a year. There are other gauges of top executives. And the governor is a public servant, and there are a lot of people. There's 221 people across the street who think they could be the governor. So why is the governor a reasonable choice?
Your Honor, I believe it's a reasonable choice because, again, we were concerned about tying the top executives, so they have the highest amount of decision-making authority, to shareholder interests. The governor, I think, has the highest amount of decision-making authority on the state compared to the other individuals that might be higher paid. So we linked it to the highest decision-maker and his corresponding salary.
When you say highest decision-maker, I don't see that in the commission's order. I mean, that might be helpful for us to say it's based on substantial evidence, but I don't see in this order, we're looking for a decision-maker.
Your Honor, it says the top executive. I think that's the inference from the order.
But isn't the top executive the top 10 executives, or like, for example, the head of the Department of the State's Investment Board. That's a top executive, $450,000 a year.
Again, Your Honor, I'm not asserting it's the perfect proxy or the only proxy. The commission believes it was a reasonable choice. But again, if this court disagrees on this point, it's clear that a remand is the appropriate remedy in that case for additional findings or to identify a different proxy. And I'll just note that Excel never identified a different proxy on the record. And when we have to...
But to be fair, the commission or the ALJ didn't suggest that it was going to look at a different proxy either. So they didn't really have the opportunity to say, well, it's better to look at the head of the State Investment Board or something else, right?
Correct, Your Honor. But even on reconsideration, they didn't suggest a different proxy. They simply argued that their executive comp was reasonable. And also, I just want to note that, you know, in the brief and at this oral argument today, they've cited evidence that the commission excluded from the record, and that they didn't appeal that decision. And it's really inappropriate to rely on that information in their brief or oral argument when the commission rejected it. Because the record was closed and didn't appeal it. Your Honor, I see I'm out of time.
I'm still stuck on the salary piece because we've got a public servant of who was selected. The world of people who can hold the office of governor is very different than the world of people who can run a public traded, highly regulated utility company. And so are we comparing Apple? It's not an apples to apples comparison.
Your Honor, I think you have to look at the context of what the commission was struggling with. That under the interstate power case, when a company doesn't prove its burden, you deny it outright or you come up with a reasonable amount based on the record. There's nothing in the record.
That's the reasonable amount that I'm struggling
with. Right. No, I know.
Like, why not go look at other utilities and make a comparison to other utilities across the nation and say, okay, here's what is reasonable for this highly specialized job?
Because it's a different question what the other utilities pay their executives versus what is appropriate for ratepayers to pay versus shareholders. So there is a market comparison in the record that says that Excel sets their executives at the median for other public utilities. But what that report doesn't tell us is how much of those executives' compensation is funded by either shareholders or ratepayers, and that's the key question. And there's nothing in the record about why ratepayers should bear this cost. And so I understand why the court is struggling with why did you go with the governor's salary. I understand that, but look at the position the commission was in. We had to set, we either disallow it or we set a reasonable proxy. There's nothing in the record that allows us to set the reasonable proxy. In fact, you know, the other salaries of public officials, the public record, perhaps we could have taken administrative notice of that, but it wasn't in the record. And so with an extremely limited record, the commission went with the governor's salary because there was nothing else in the record to act as a proxy.
I appreciate that, counsel, but as you know, the commission does have to show its work, right, and explain the basis of its decision. Don't you agree?
I agree, Your Honor. And once again, the commission submits that its path was discernible, that it was sufficient. But again, if this court disagrees, the remand's the appropriate remedy, and the court and the commission can make additional findings or pick a more reasonable proxy if that's the direction this court goes.
I know we're way out of time, but I have an insurance question.
Please.
So my question on insurance is this. The commission required Excel to produce more detailed information from insurance brokers instead of just relying upon the expert testimony, which the ALJ found to be sufficient. It seems to me that it's the commission's holding Excel to a standard higher than preponderance of the evidence by saying, yeah, you submitted evidence of expert testimony, but you should have done more.
And Your Honor, I address this in my brief. I think that had Excel's request been in line with historical expenses, they wouldn't have required more. And I can't talk about the specific numbers because they're trade secret, but if you look in the testimony and look at the magnitude of the increase from 2021 to 2020 to 22, and the commission details in its order why that wasn't explained, it said that sort of increase requires more robust burden of proof. But then I think the second part, and this is where opposing counsel misreads the commission's order. He says, the commission's order only addressed these factors going to the actual insurance premium, not the NEIL distribution. There's two paragraphs in the commission order addressing the NEIL distribution. The ALJ didn't address that at all. It's an independent reason why the commission found that this was not appropriate, or their projections were not appropriate. And again, if you look at my brief on page 39, you can see how this number fluctuates up and down, the NEIL distribution. And that's all you have to see to uphold the commission's decision, because if you look at the People's Natural Gas case, this exact methodology where costs, we're setting a representative amount for rates. And when that varies widely, using historical average is completely appropriate. It's been used in multiple PUC cases. It's been upheld by this Court of Appeals. And that's really the key here. And again, the 2024 update they did in November, and I think counsel admits it, makes no mention about whether that accounts for these distributions. That's key. The distributions are an incredibly large portion of the overall insurance premium expense. So this idea that we can accurately calculate half of the equation, the other one varies widely, and our own expert testified that it's unpredictable, right? But yet somehow you should ignore the part we can't calculate accurately and go with our insurance expense. It was that huge difference between historical expenses and actual expenses. And the other issue, you know, counsel said that it's not in the record, the historic overcollection. If you look to the transcript in the May 23rd hearing, and I can get you the specific record site if you'd like, but Commissioner Tuma questioned directly Excel's counsel about the historic over-budgeting, over-forecasting of insurance expenses. That information wasn't provided by Excel in the record, presumably because it's bad for their case to show that they're that they've been historically inaccurate, but it is a public record. It's in the four previous rate cases you can look to, and you can see clearly that they over-collected them. Excel's counsel at the oral argument had an opportunity to deny that they over-collected amounts. They didn't deny it, and you'll notice that in their brief and at oral argument, they're very careful not to deny it. We may have over-collected. We may have over-forecasted. So oral argument is part of the record, and It is there, but you don't even have to rely on it, because even looking at just the 2021 expense alone, the over-forecasting is so great that it allows the commission to come in and use an average. Otherwise, you're relying on a methodology to set just and reasonable rates that doesn't set just and reasonable rates, but only to the benefit of the shareholders, not ever in the direction of the shareholders.
Ratepayers.
Sorry, excuse me. A lot of names being thrown around. So, Your Honor, I'm way past time. If there's additional questions, otherwise, I just ask that you affirm the commission's decisions. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Your Honor, beginning with the prepaid pension asset issue. Judge Schmidt, you asked about, isn't there some evidence? Is there evidence that there were contributions? The answer is yes, and it's the Schedule 6, which is page 15491 of the record, and it shows that there's $1.5 billion in cumulative contributions. So I think, look, if you want to remand the case, what it needs to be remanded for would be a determination of what portion of the prepaid pension asset is a function of shareholder contributions as opposed to something else, and that was the remedy that was given in the Minnesota Power case. You can't just deny the prepaid pension assets recovery in whole because you think there might be some share that's market return based. But in this case, and this is the second point, we don't think that remand is appropriate or needed. And I would just note that my counterpart did not dispute my argument that under the aggregate cost method, there can be no negative pension expense. Market returns can never increase the amount that Excel is on the left side of the equation, the contributions. It's only shareholder contributions that fund it. His entire argument is based on a conflation between what funds and what affects the prepaid pension asset. He says that they would allow recovery to the extent that shareholders funded it, but then his entire argument is that market returns affect the prepaid pension asset by mitigating expense. That is right. They affect the prepaid pension asset, but they do not fund the prepaid pension asset. And let me give you a very simple example to understand what the difference is. Imagine you have Excel. It's contributed $10, okay, to the pension trust. Now, year one, let's say there's a dollar in pension expense. Then the prepaid pension asset becomes $9. Okay. Let's say instead there are lots of market returns. The market returns were $2. Okay. That means pension expense in year one is zero. There's still $10 of shareholder contributed funds in the prepaid pension asset, and that is what Excel seeks to recover return on. There's not $11, there's not $12, there's only $10. That's what makes this case different from the Minnesota Power case. There can't be negative pension expense under Excel's methodology, and so what's funding the prepaid pension asset is only shareholder contributions. That is the key issue. And as to the notion that there's no evidence of that, that's false. Look at Addendum 234 through 236, and also Addendum 252. There's lots of evidence about that. So that's what I have to say about the prepaid pension asset, unless you have questions about that issue. On executive compensation, the commission can't kind of make a freewheeling, well, what's kind of a reasonable amount to pay? It needs to be a determination that's grounded in evidence relating to the statute. The statute tells you the standard the commission needs to use in assessing what reasonable means. It's revenue sufficient to enable the utility to meet the cost of furnishing the service. Well, so the question is, what is a reasonable amount for a utility to pay for executives like a CEO, a CFO, a general counsel, a chief customer officer? What does the market require the utility to pay for those executives? And the answer is, we're at the median. And I would point you to...
you would not argue that your base compensation is going to attract those people.
I agree with that, Your Honor, but the fact that we haven't asked for the whole enchilada doesn't mean that we're entitled to $150,000.
Right, it undermines the reasoning that you have, which is we need to attract and we need to pay total comp of X. Therefore, you should compare that against whether you could get them for $150,000 when you're not even asking for that. And for good reason, right? You don't get all of AIP either. You know, there's a recognition that shareholder interests are at some point not aligned with the ratepayers' interests, right?
Well,
I
don't agree with that, but I don't think I need to have that argument today in order to prevail, because again, the fact that we didn't ask for everything doesn't mean that they can just arbitrarily set a random number. And if you look at page 15713 of the record, it's the Lowenthal testimony, and it says our base salary is overall, excluding the target AIP, below market. So we've acted reasonably in seeking this recovery from shareholders. And the idea that because we didn't ask for more, we should get less, I don't think makes any sense. There's a basis in the evidence for what we've requested, and the commission can't simply disregard that evidence and pluck out some sort of random comparator. The relevant proxy, he says there's no proxy. The relevant proxy is, well, what does the market require to hire utility executives of this kind, looking at base salary alone at least? And that's what we've provided. And there's no counter evidence.
Or some relevant proxy that the commission can justify, right? I mean, it seems like it would be an encroachment on the commission's authority to tell them, here's the universe of possibilities that you can consider. I mean...
Well, there's no evidence in the record about any other proxy that might be appropriate. And I don't think
I'm a little troubled by that, about that if they choose a reasonable number in their judgment and explain it, that it necessarily has to be based on evidence that was presented in the record as opposed to some other justified explanation based on their experience or expertise. What is the legal basis for the position that you're advocating?
The legal basis is the statute, which entitles us to recover the costs necessary to furnish the service. And so you need to look, well, what are the costs necessary to furnish the service? There can't be a dispute that we don't need a CEO, a CFO, et cetera. We need those. So what is necessary to furnish to hire those employees to do their job. And what's necessary is, based on the market proxy data that we submitted that was undisputed, there was no cross-examination about it. I mean,
and do we balance that against the other statutory obligation to ensure that, or that the commission is charged with, to ensure that the rates are just and reasonable?
Well, I think the rates are just and reasonable when there's a justification in the record for why the costs were necessary to furnish the service. And that's true of all expenses that a utility incurs and all assets the utility invests in. You don't get to say, well, I think $10 was too much to pay for that pole. I'm going to only pay you $6 when the evidence in the record shows, no, poles cost $10. And executives are no different. So if I could just say one thing about, or two quick things about insurance. Your Honor, thank you very much. I appreciate it. My colleague says that had the data been in line with historical expense, the commission wouldn't have required more evidence. Well, with respect to the portion of the data that the commission was quibbling with, which was market-based insurance purchases, the forecast was in line with historical expense. So we satisfied our burden. As he notes, the real swing comes from Neal distributions, and he says the commission was entitled to look at historical averages. The commission didn't look at historical averages. The commission cherry-picked a 2021 year that had a very, very high Neal distribution that everyone acknowledged was unanticipated, and used that as the baseline for the 2022 year.
A twin issue? I mean, didn't they look at historical averages by looking at the expenses which included the Neal distributions historically, as opposed to the forecast historically? I thought that there was a difference in between deciding what the average increases and pegging it from the 2021 year. Like there are sort of two differences.
So if you look at record page 14432, again, it's small print, so get your magnifying glass out. But that shows the historical insurance expense. Okay,
and does that expense is net of the distributions?
It shows all the different subcategories of expense. So it shows what the contribution of surplus distributions was to the net, and you'll see that's the big driver of swings. Mm-hmm. That's the big driver. So what do you do with that information? Well, you need to make a forecast. You need to project somehow. Excel's evidence and this is at addendum 205. It used 3-year rolling guidance from Neal and its past experience, and that told it that it would expect smaller distributions in the future. That was the only evidence in the record about that. It was unrebutted, and the commission disregarded that and instead just assumed that the future would be like 2021, when that's the one thing everyone acknowledges can't be, right? Because that was a very outsized year that was unanticipated. So their assumption is simply counter to the evidence in the record. Thank you so much for the extra time this morning, Your Honor.
Thank you both for giving us extra time. And for your briefing, the case is submitted. We'll have a decision out in a statutory time period. I'm going to ask counsel, colleagues, want a minute? Okay, we're going to take just 5 minutes max, and then we'll be back for the next case. Okay.
Nice.